Welcome to the Joseph Campbell Audio Collection. This talk is called Confrontation of East and West in Religion. It is the third selection in the series entitled Inward Journey, East and West. And now, Joseph Campbell.
Well, our topic tonight is the confrontation of East and West in religion. And when I was a student back in the 20s, one never would have thought that in the 70s one would be talking about religion. At that time, we were all perfectly convinced that we were through with that. The science and reason, the war had been won, the First World War, the world had been made safe for the rational world of democracy and so forth. Aldous Huxley, in his first phase, Point Counterpoint, was our hero, Bernard Shaw, and people like that. But in the midst of all this optimism about reason and the light, there appeared a work, 1921 and 1922, that was disturbing, and that was Spengler's Decline of the West. And about the same time, within a span of 5 years, there was Thomas Mann's Magic Mountain, there was Joyce's Ulysses, there was Eliot's Wasteland, there was Proust's Remembrance of Things Past. Those were great years. But what the story of these works seemed to say was that with all of this rational movement and progressive achievement and illumination of the dark quarters of the world, there was something beginning to disintegrate in our Occidental system itself. And I think of these that Spengler's was the most disquieting. It was based on the concept of an organic continuity, a morphology of history, that a culture has its years of youth, its years of fulfillment, its years then of beginning to totter and try to hold itself up with rational reasoning and organizations, and then a sort of petrifaction and decrepitude and no more life. And in this view of Spengler's, we are at the point of passing from what he called the culture to the civilization period, which is to say from a period of spontaneous and wonderful creativity to a period of anxious formulations and the beginning of the end. When he sought for analogies in the classical world, our moment today in the mid-20th century corresponded to that of the classical world in the 2nd century BC, the period of the Carthaginian Wars, the decline of the culture world of Greece, and the rise of Rome, Caesarism, and what he called the second religiousness, politics based on providing the people with bread and circuses, and a general tendency toward violence and brutality in the arts and pastimes of people. Well, this came out in the 20s, and it has been something of a life experience to watch the not so gradual coming into fulfillment of the world that Spengler wrote about. And I can remember we used to sit around and discuss this and try to find how you could beat it down and try to find what the positive things were in this moment of crisis and transition. And Spengler himself said that in the period of transition from culture to civilization, there is a dropping of the culture forms. This is astonishing to be teaching today students that find the whole history of our civilization irrelevant. The forms are dropped. I mean, that's the word they use. And they don't seem to have the will to encompass it all. Kind of, one thinks, on the negative side, a kind of a failure of will. But then one thinks about the matter in another way and thinks of the concatenation of new problems and new influences to be absorbed. And one can then understand that the energies are brought forward here. And perhaps we could think of Spengler's concept, not only are we dropping the culture forms, but we are beginning to shape the civilization forms, and this is a great moment on that head. And then there was another author who thought of civilization and culture in terms of morphological processes, and this was Frobenius, whose name is anathema among our American Anthropological Society people. His concept was of three great total stages in the human development. The first, a primitive stage, as we call it, before the emergence of the high culture forms with monumental art and literate philosophy and historical writings with developed mathematics and so forth. That second stage of the literate civilizations beginning about the middle of the fourth millennium BC, what he called the monumental stage. But then this wonderful moment of ours, as I pointed out in my first talk here in this series, that of a global world. No longer the little province-oriented civilizations. When you think how tiny the Egyptian, how tiny the Mesopotamian, how tiny the Indian, the Chinese, the European, in comparison with this global world that we're in now, Frobenius had the idea that we were in the beginning of another great and perhaps final phase that would last for thousands of years of the human race. And that seemed to be very exciting as well. And so I confront this problem with these two men in my mind and think of this as being a moment, so to say, in the life course of humanity itself, passing from the period of maturity to a period of age with a new kind of wisdom which comes with age, which we, whether we're young or old, now have to function to serve as organs of this great, great new stage in our civilization. And with this the case, what we notice when we turn to the world of religion is a most fantastic disequilibrium. All of the traditional religions are in great disorder. Their concepts do not hold. And yet there's a very great religious fervor among not only young people, but older people as well. The religious fervor, however, is in a mystical direction. And the teachers who seem to be saying most to many are those who've come from a world that was formerly thought of as inconsequential in this great human development, a world that had dropped off and represented only archaic and outgrown modes of thinking. We have the teachers from India, we have the teachers from Japan, and we have also the old Chinese sages, all of these saying something to us. Now, last week I spoke of the disintegration of a psyche in the West in terms of schizophrenia, where not being able to keep up with the demands of the outside part of our civilization, that is to say, what is called the establishment or the institutions which make terrific demands on us, a person cracks off and sinks into the abyss of his psyche and gets lost there. And I pointed out that what he encounters there are exactly the archetypal forms and motifs that are the basic forms and motifs of the religious traditions of the world. And I said, and I'll say again, that these forms are the same everywhere. Basically, the archetypes of religion, the archetypes of meditation, the archetypes of schizophrenic discovery in the interior of the psyche are the same everywhere, but they are given different emphases in different parts of the world. Why is it that the emphases that have been given to these in the East are saying more to most of us today than the emphases that were given in the West? This is a little point I'd like to discuss at the opening now of this talk. I think of a very interesting analogy to our contemporary situation, which occurred on the American plains, the American Indian plains, in the 1880s and 90s. As you possibly remember, that was the time, hardly 100 years ago, when the railroad was put across the plains and the buffalo killers were sent out to kill off the buffalo herds to make way for the new world of planting culture that was moving into the Great Plains, the wheat growers instead of the buffalo killers. And another function of this killing off of the buffalo was to deprive the Plains Indians of their food supply so that they would really have to submit to the life on the reservations and be corralled and put away. And the Indians then were deprived of what had been the central symbol of their plains religions, namely the buffalo. The relationship of the human community to the animal community which supplied its food was the central pivotal thought of the social religion of these people. And with the buffalo gone, the basic image was gone, and the society no longer had the capacity to integrate the individual with nature and his life through the mythological symbols of the cult. The religion was suddenly archaic within 4 years. And it was then that the peyote cult, the mezcal cult, came up from Mexico and flooded over the plains with a great success. Many accounts, and they would eat the buttons. There would be a great lodge, everybody gather in the lodge with prayers and chants and so forth, and then they would start eating these mezcal buttons and seek within themselves what had been lost to them in the society. Now, as I said last week, the function of a mythological symbol is to awaken the energies of life. It is an energy awakening and releasing sign. Not only does it awaken your own life energies and make life something that turns you on, as we say today, but it turns you on in a certain direction which makes you function in the context of a society. Now, when the symbols are no longer associated with the social order, but have cracked off, the zeal of the individual is dissociated from the society. There takes place a sort of pathology of the symbol. Now, Dr. John Perry, whom I mentioned last week in connection with the schizophrenia, uses a term, affect image. This is exactly the counterpart of the phrase I had been using, an energy awaking and directing sign. A mythological symbol is an affect image. It's an image that hits you in a place where it counts. It doesn't talk to the brain and have to be interpreted. It talks directly to the psyche so that there is an immediate response. There is a resonance within you to the image. We won't try to discuss how that comes about. There are many theories and many ways of explaining this, but it is a fact that mythological symbols, when properly rendered, turn you on. When rendered in a social context that is alive, it relates you to the society and turns the whole society on. When the symbols no longer are effective, there is a dissociation of the individual from the society. Now, there can be a dropout here. The mythological symbol serves four main functions, as I pointed out last week. The first is that of relating you to the ultimate mystery of existence. Existence is mysterious, and that's the wonder of it. It is monstrous, and that's the marvel of it. The second thing the mythological imagery does is present a total image of the universe. But that total image of the universe must be up to date. A religion that carries a symbol system that is 4,000 years old is not going to turn anybody on. It's got to be in relationship to this fabulous universe that we experience today. In that sense, our traditional religions have dropped off. How about the Orient? Anyone who has read any of the Oriental myths and images of the universe has read of a cosmos with galaxies and galaxies, in fact, the cosmos that we have. Furthermore, that imagery is simply to relate you to the marvel of the universe. Whereas in our tradition, the universe is simply the cloak of a divine being who is outside of it. In the Orient, the divinity is right in the universe itself. The third function of a traditional mythology is to validate and maintain a certain social order, this specific social order in which you're functioning. The social order that is represented in our tradition is quite archaic. We are in flux as far as our morals are concerned. The problems of today are not those of the first and second centuries BC. They're totally different. And those commandments and so forth that we carry with us as luggage just don't convince. And anyone who stands up to talk about them is just not talking to today. Our society is secular, not religiously based. The order of law is not divinely inspired. It is arranged by people reasonably sitting down and saying what would be a reasonable aim for life and how do we achieve it, what kind of institutions would achieve it. So there is a secularization of our society, a secularization of our universe, and two of the functions of mythology have been taken over by the secular sciences. The fourth function is the psychological one of carrying a person through the crises of his life. And that's now the function of psychology. Clergymen are going to psychoanalysts to learn how to carry on their pastoral function of advising people in their psychological development. So, just as for the American Indian, the buffalo dropped away, and with it their public social mythology, so for us. The world has moved past, and our mythology has dropped off, and we are turned inward, and the Oriental people are the ones who are teaching us how to turn inward in this adventurous quest of finding again those images in ourselves which the society can no longer render to us. Now let me tell three little anecdotes to illustrate the problem of East and West in religion. Back some 15 years ago, Dr. Martin Buber was over here in the United States lecturing. And a group of scholars like myself who were interested in comparative religions were invited to hear a special series of lectures in one of the rooms up at Columbia. And this eloquent little man, he's a remarkably small man, with however a magnificent presence. He had this charisma people talk about. And when you realize that English was his second language, it was almost incredible to imagine a man lecturing with such eloquence and fluency and zeal. But I was becoming, as he was lecturing about the history of the Old Testament and the Hebrew people, I was becoming more and more unable to understand what he meant by a certain word he was using. So, to tell you ahead of time, the word was God. I didn't know what he meant by this word. whether he meant that mystery which is somehow thought of as responsible for this magnitudinous universe, or that specific local character Yahweh, whom one encounters in the Old Testament, or some kind of person with whom Martin Buber himself had conversations. Because he said at one moment, he broke off his talk and he looked pained, and he said, it pains me to speak of God in the third person. Well, when I communicated that little remark to another Jewish philosopher from Tel Aviv, he said, sometimes he goes too far. So, with this word slipping around like that, I had the impudence to raise my hand, and he very generously looked at me and said, what is it? I said, Dr. Buber, there is a word being used here this evening. I do not understand. What is that word, Mr. Campbell? I said, God. Well, his eyes opened, and he said, you don't know what God means? And I said, well, I don't know what you mean by God. You're telling us this evening that God has hidden his face, that God no longer shows himself to man. But I have just come from India, and I had been there the year before, just come back, and I said, people there are experiencing God all the time. And he looked, and his hands went out, and he said, do you mean to compare? And at that moment, Dr. Talbot, who was the MC, cut in, and he said, no, doctor, don't say it, you know. Mr. Campbell just wants to know what you mean. Well, Dr. Buber, he sort of backed away and took a second stride, and he was going to wipe the whole thing off. And he just said, well, everybody has to come out of his exile in his own way. Well, that was an awkward remark, because the Orient is not in exile from its God. The God is immanent within you. He isn't out there. And you haven't been cut off. You're not cut off. The only point is, you don't know how to turn in and get to it. It's nobody's fault but your own, and the problem is not a problem of fall and atonement or exile and coming out of exile. It's a psychological problem totally, and it can be solved.